Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ben Barker. He's a writer, activist, and farmer from West Bend. He's currently writing a book about the toxic qualities of radical subcultures and the need to build a vibrant culture of resistance. Read more at www.benbarker.org. So thank you, Ben, for being on the radio program today.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess my first question is, what do you mean by radical subculture? And then second, what are the four main areas of difficulty that you see in radical subcultures?
Sure. Well, I am defining a subculture in contrast to both a movement and a community. And there's a writer named Dick Hebdige from the UK who wrote a book about the subcultures there in the 70s and 80s. And there are very particular subcultures that he was addressing, but he gave a definition for subculture that I think works across time and space. And essentially, he called it an attempt to make meaning out of style. And a subculture is basically a culture within a culture, but it exists to be antagonistic to that larger culture. And the way that it antagonizes is through style. So whether that style is protest or art or sexuality, it's symbolic to its core. And that is different than a movement where we have a strategy and a program. And it's different than a community, which in its true form, we hope would be self-sufficient and full of healthy human relationships. So the four main issues that I see.
Before we get to that, can you give me some like historical examples of subcultures then? Because I think I understand what you're saying, but I'd like to be a little bit more clear. And examples really help me.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I can speak to the subcultures that I myself have been through and that I think are prevalent today. So I started out with the punk rock subculture. That was my introduction into radical politics. And then I moved from there into the anarchist subculture. And then from there, I went into the genderqueer subculture. And so an amalgamation of all these experiences in these different subcultures led me to believe that maybe I couldn't be radical outside of the subcultures. And it was a big breakthrough for me when I realized that my goals and aims as an activist did not have to be tied to these social groups that I found really confining.
Well, when you say that a subculture, give the definition of subculture again, and then what are the larger movements or cultures to which they are antagonistic? Like, what is the punk rock subculture antagonistic to? That's what I'm a little bit unclear on.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the definition of a subculture is a culture within a culture that exists to antagonize that larger culture. And so the punk rock subculture, for example, is antagonistic to this broad idea called society. But it's different than, say, an activist group, which certainly has its own culture situated within, you know, the dominant culture that we would call capitalism or patriarchy or civilization. But what makes it different is that it doesn't end there. That culture, that activist group's internal culture is actually something that those activists are striving to kind of transcend that culture in which it was created. Whereas the subcultures, I think, are content with just having this kind of alternative culture situated inside the larger culture. They're not actually working on bringing down the larger culture.
So thank you for that. What are the big problems that you see within radical subcultures? You mentioned that there were four.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to preface that by saying that I don't think that those activists who are immersed in subcultures are automatically problematic or automatically incapable of participating in robust social movements or healthy, vibrant communities. I just think that, and while subculture certainly can help an activist to get a start, they certainly did for me, I think that the longer an activist stays in the subculture, the more disillusioned and hopeless will become. And that's because I think that these subcultures are not really just benign, which they are in a political and strategic sense, but also the internal workings of these subcultures can be very toxic. And that's where I come to these four different areas that I've pointed out. And the first one, do you want me to list them all now, or should we take them one by one?
Well, no, let's list them and then take them one by one. But before that, I'm thinking that, I mean, aren't there going to be a lot of people who are really upset at what you just said? And aren't there going to be a lot of people who go, wow, the whole punk movement has been incredibly important for changing society as a whole. And I'm not saying this for myself, because I was never interested in punk at all. But won't they say that, like, Iggy and the Stooges or the Sex Pistols were really important for changing the dominant culture?
Well, I can say that the subcultures can be important for those individuals or groups who are feeling really marginalized, but a lot of times it's just those groups who are feeling marginalized rather than those who are actually marginalized. So for a lot of actually oppressed groups of people throughout history, they haven't really found a home or an effective strategy within the subculture. So yeah, some people might be a little ticked off that I'm saying that subcultures haven't really been effective, but a lot of those people aren't the ones most negatively impacted by the dominant culture.
Okay, so maybe throughout the whole rest of the time you can help me understand this point more. So should we go through what are the four areas and then you can discuss them and maybe help bring this all together for me?
Sure, yeah. The four areas, the first one is privilege, and I'm comparing that to equality. And the next one is a fixation on lifestyle purity versus a plan for social change. Third is distraction, which I'm comparing to discipline. And lastly is horizontal hostility, in contrast to a functioning community. So should we start with privilege?
That sounds great.
Okay, great. Well, I have a dear neighbor who says there's nothing radical about treating powerless people like garbage. And throughout all my experiences within the radical subcultures, I see again and again that those who are those who have less power just get dumped on over and over by the same people professing some kind of goal towards collective liberation or equality. And as those people who get dumped on know very well, changing one's clothes or rhetoric, calling oneself radical, doesn't erase the privilege that we have by virtue of being born as, in my case, a white guy with, you know, a middle-class background. And I think that the subcultures, instead of furthering our aims towards justice, can actually reinforce inequality in pretty pernicious ways. So one is that a lot of times subcultures are filled with fairly well-off, often white people, and they exacerbate the gap between we of privilege, we the white middle class background, and, you know, the poor, the struggling, a lot of times people of color. If our politics and also just what we do, how those politics manifest, don't actually lead us towards the struggles of everyday people, towards understanding and engaging in those struggles, then we really are just being pushed further and further away, or really just staying elevated in this very abstract theoretical realm. So an example would be a lot of anarchist theory is, you know, can be really wonderful, but if that anarchist theory leads not to, you know, actually struggling to take down capitalism, but instead to weekly theoretical book clubs, you know, which can be fine if that's not the only thing you're doing, but what about when it is the only thing you're doing and it becomes this kind of elevated status that you and maybe a few of your friends have where you can talk theory at the expense of struggling?
Well, I'm thinking two things about that. One of them is that I remember, I mean, just it's fine to sit around with friends and hang out, but honestly, a lot of my favorite times I've ever had with friends have been when we are, working while we talk, you know, whether it is when I was younger, you know, I might just hang out with my friends and that's fine, but it's also really nice to, you know, be hauling hay when we do it, or to be gardening, or to be, you know, actually accomplishing something. I think of this line all the time by Carl Jung, which is philosophy butters no parsnip. Mm-hmm. And what I take that to mean is that, yeah, we can talk philosophy all we want, but at the end of the day, you know, it's nice to actually have something done. You know, it's like they asked Lewis Mumford one time, the social critic, excuse me, they asked him something about whether he wanted to get a dishwasher. And he said, no, because I actually enjoy standing there. You know, my wife washes the dishes and I dry them and we stand there and have a nice conversation while we do it. And I'm just thinking about this in terms of, you know, I didn't come to where I am with all this through radical politics. I came to all this through grassroots environmental activism, where we would get together. It was very task oriented. We're going to file a timber sale appeal. We're going to stop this particular horrible thing from happening. And theory emerged from practice as opposed to talking about theory. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Absolutely. And I think I'll touch on that a little bit more when we talk about lifestyle purity.
Okay. Okay, well, the second thing I wanted to say about this whole theoretical thing is that another thing that can happen when you get really theoretically abstract and have all these abstract discussions is that it's really easy to get yourself talked into atrocity and talked into making some completely outrageous statements because theoretically you can find a justification for them, but in the real world they're really terrible. And one of the ways I think about this is the support that has been present for really horrible things like pedophilia in anarchism. And you'll find that both major U.S. anarchist magazines support pedophilia and have been pro-pedophile at times in the recent past. And one of the ways they get there is by talking about how individual liberty is so important, and then they talk about liberty in this weird way such that it ends up that if you stop pedophiles from exploiting children, that you're actually oppressing the children. Because the children, they say, should be allowed to express their sexuality. It ends up really horribly oppressive through all this, you know, and actually we don't even have to talk about anarchism. We can say the same thing about capitalism with, you know, you can have this theory that says that the world is supposed to work a certain way, but when you get out actually into the real world, you have all these weird economic theories, but in the real world, they cause real atrocity. A great example of this is a line by Eduardo Galeano, where he quotes a Brazilian general during one of the dictatorships. They asked him how the economy was doing. He said, the economy is doing very well, the people not so well. And so for me, it always comes back to, you know, what is happening in the real physical world. Is any of this applying to anything you're saying?
Yeah, and it reminds me of one of my least favorite dichotomies that I've heard amongst radicals is between safety and freedom. And a lot of times they're arguing for freedom at the expense of safety, and actually drawing this, I think, kind of insane conclusion that you need to have complete and total freedom. And I think that that's really impossible in a healthy human community.
Well, I think that since we all die, it's, yeah. Anyway, sorry, go ahead. Okay, so go ahead with privilege and then purity if you want to go there.
Sure. Well, that discussion that we were just having leads well into the next point, which is the male dominated aspect of radical subcultures. So a lot of times we'll see masculinity being passed off as militancy, as if all militancy is an expression of manhood. And that really leads to male dominated politics. Politics that women can't identify with, that don't serve women. It leads to male-dominated groups where women are really relegated to just support roles for the heroic men. It also leads to violence against women. You know, just saying that you're a radical or that your group is radical doesn't eliminate the reality that it's very frequently women are assaulted within those radical groups. As we've seen again and again. And it's really this kind of masculine version of militancy is a sort of blind fury. And you know, when there is a culture of blind masculine aggression, as we see in the dominant culture, no one is really safe. And I'm afraid that a lot of the radical left has become just another area where men can blow off steam at the expense of everyone else. So it's really those who have promised to stand up in the face of injustice, that's us, radicals, are too easily lulled by its rewards, the power and privilege that we experience because whole groups of people are subservient to us, really. And the choice, the incentive that we have is nothing except doing what's right. There's no material reward that we're going to get for standing up to the kind of superiority and violation that is the hallmark of power. And the only reward really we get is a clean conscience and a contribution to genuine social change. So I'm happy to talk about purity now, unless there's anything else you'd like to add.
Oh, that's great. Go ahead. That's great.
Okay, so then we come to lifestyle purity, and a lot of radicals will recognize the fallacy of lifestyle purity when found in liberals. So, you know, we're the most, we most frequently level critiques at liberals for their ideas about, you know, green consumption as a path to environmental sustainability and on and on. But there's this wonderful quote by the political strategist Gene Sharp, and I think it really highlights how lifestyle purity is a bigger issue on the left. So he says, "Condemnation of social evil, espousal of an alternative order of life, a deep personal commitment, and an effort to live according to it are all good and necessary, but unfortunately alone, they do not transform human society and institutions. To do that, an instrumentally effective program of achievable steps for dealing with the evils of existing society and for creating an improved social order is required." And now I can see a lot of radicals just really cringing at that because it highlights that you know, as activists, we actually have to have a program for social change, and it can't just be about ourselves and our feeling holier than thou. And so a lot of times we'll see radicals claiming the status of radical because we have some kind of esoteric fashion, or we have some kind of extreme method of protest, or a unique sexuality. And so the various subcultures that I was involved with really emphasized things like, you know, living this kind of vagabond lifestyle by choice. So maybe like living intentionally in poverty, or just dressing that way. And, you know, the less nutritious food you ate from the most precarious places was the degree to which you were really a radical. or this fetishization of rioting is another example. In the anarchist subculture, rioting is really seen as the way that you can be active. But a lot of times, it's, again, that blind masculine fury paired with a total lack of effective strategy. And then we get to sexuality, and so there's this whole subculture that asserts that, you know, the kind of sex that you're having or the kind of sexuality you identify with is in fact a radical action. So I think radicals would do well to ask ourselves, are we after social change or individual change? And by that I mean, is our strategy to get to whatever change we're looking for just based on ourselves, just based on how we feel? And then what is the outcome going to be? Is the outcome of whatever activism we are participating in going to help shape a better world, or is it just going to make us feel better?
Well, I want to back up for a second and read a quote, because, I mean, you know, for a long time I didn't understand. I mean, I'd heard people say the thing about our sexual habits are, you know, going to change society, but here's a quote from a quote from some anarchists about what they mean by this changing culture through a sexual act. And they use the, I'm gonna change one word since we're on the radio, but we can all guess what the original word was. Public sex, this is them. Public sex then is a biopolitical strike, an attack of desiring bodies against this world and what we live in screwing wherever we please. We act to sabotage the mechanisms of social control. We refuse our relationship to the factory and cease to work. Rather, we choose to act only in the capacities that bring us the most explosive and dangerous joys. And that, you know, I don't see how them having sex in public is supposed to shut down the machine. And in fact, the day after I read that line, I was on the phone with my friend Stephanie McMillan, and she said that the day before she saw some lizards having sex on the sidewalk and wondered then why the capitalist mechanism of social control is still in place. And it's just this, you know, had I not read lines like that over and over, I wouldn't have had any idea what you're talking about, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand how, I mean, there may be a lot of listeners to this who are as baffled as I by how anybody could believe that this could actually change society.
Right. And it was that book that you're quoting from was actually the most popular among the so-called radicals that I was surrounded by in the most recent subculture that I found myself in. And that kind of those kinds of ideas contributed largely to me just having a clean break from the subcultures, because like you and most sane people, I didn't understand how that kind of, you know, idea was going to contribute to a better world, and I thought that was the point.
Yeah, I want to read one more, and once again, I'm going to change some language here. just so people really get the idea. And the article states, we're 17 and having sex in a public museum. I'm on my knees with your something in my mouth, surrounded by Mayan art and tiger statues. Our hushed whispers and frenzied breathing become a secret language of power, and us becoming monstrous, eating whole restraint and apology. The world ruptures as we orgasm, but it isn't enough. We want it all, of course, to expropriate the public as a wild zone of becoming orgy and to destroy what stands in our way. And I have a couple things about that that I want to say, which is, one is, I mean, do these people realize they're not actually the first people ever to discover sex? And the second thing is that I think it's really important that we should acknowledge and we should respond to them, actually, that sex doesn't have to be a language of power. And in fact, shouldn't. The same culture wouldn't, but instead can be a language of affection, care, closeness, pleasure, love. And it's, I mean, I guess I'm just repeating myself, but it just boggles my mind that this can, in some people's mind, I can't even talk, you know, this, it makes no sense to me how this can be construed as a form of significant social change.
Right, much less ethical behavior or ethical ideas.
Well, that's the thing, too, is nobody else in the museum asked to participate in their sexuality. That's the thing, is they're forcing their sexuality on other people who are there. And where does, you know, they like to throw out the word consent. Where does consent come in? You know, the other people didn't consent to be voyeurs to their sexuality.
Right.
Sorry, I think I've sort of derailed it. So can you bring us back to the lifestyle purity?
Sure. Well, I'll just close by saying that the rejection of society, you know, that is really hallmark to radical subcultures, and the rejection of institutions leads to total ineffectiveness, because if we are trying to just pretend basically that institutions don't exist or that they're too rotten to engage with at all, then we're not going to change institutions that actually affect the material reality of people's lives on a large scale. So essentially we're just going to be in our own little bubble, not participating in society at all, because we want to prove that we reject it. And I think a way out of this, at least for me, was to find a class analysis, and that really let me be a little more selfless in my approach to social change and see that, you know, whatever privileges I have, it's not actually helpful to just pretend like I don't have them because I think they're rotten or whatever. Instead, I need to use them to contribute to social change.
And it seems to me about this whole purity thing that, especially with the particular subcultures that you're talking about, that if you reject the organization and what you're left with really is changing yourself. So really all that's left is purity. I mean, there's actually another direction I want to go with this for just a moment, too, that you know, I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, and I think that when we get into we could probably at some point, not today, but we could probably have an interesting conversation about the relationships between what you're talking about and the behaviors of various forms of fundamentalist religion, in that the purity was very, very important to the Adventist church when I was a kid. How, you know, did you go to movies? You know, if you went to movies, you were in a lesser class because movies were an evil place. Or if you ate pork, then you were a lesser class, because that was another thing that was forbidden. And so there was huge emphasis on this sort of purity.
Yeah. Do you support porn? Because if you don't, you're probably not a good anarchist.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So what are the other two?
So then is distraction as opposed to discipline. And that's, to me, when coping turns into a sort of careless denial. You know, reality is extremely difficult. As activists, we know that. And we need to blow off steam. We need fun and entertainment, but not at the expense of being active. You know, I have a friend who tells a story about he'd go to these radical meetings, this group that he was involved in, and they'd spend about 5 minutes organizing, another 10 minutes getting high, another 5 minutes organizing, and then the rest of the time just getting drunk until they forgot about organizing. And, you know, whether that's metaphorical or not, I think that it's true enough in my experience that a lot of emphasis is placed on just having fun, what by any means necessary, really, at the expense of putting our heads together and thinking about what could be done to actually change the injustices that our politics address. And there's a quote from Artie Lang, which you reference a lot, and that's, you can't plug a void by plugging a void. So more meaning placed, more emphasis placed on these kinds of distractions that offer kind of a quick fix means less emphasis placed on struggle, which is inherently long-term. And I think it's really useful when we start to see ourselves as members of resistance movements and communities, and as members of those, we're accountable to them. So at all times, you know, whether we're blowing off steam, having fun, or engaged in the work, we're still, we can see ourselves as being held accountable, as being principled in whatever we're doing, fun or serious or both, rather than just isolated individuals getting by, doing whatever we have to do to go from day to day. But I think that a serious activism requires the stuff that a lot of today's radicals have written off as boring. And one is education, educating ourselves in a real way, studying past resistance movements, studying strategy. Another one is reaching outside of our little insular subcultures to people that we maybe think are just regular or boring, and actually building bonds between us, so that I think that there's a lot we can gain as activists by doing outreach wherever possible. And then also getting to know one's land base. Tremendous how little I think a lot of radicals, including radical environmentalists, know about the place where they live. And, you know, as you know very well, the places where we live are not just backdrops for human activity, whether that human activity is the workings of capitalism or a radical subculture. And the land, I think, could teach us a lot, just as humans, first of all, but also as radical activists, about, you know, what it means to be a dedicated activist and what it means to be a person of principle and courage. So ultimately, I think we need this discipline for winning, and discipline, contrary to what a lot of radical subcultures have taught us, is not a dirty word.
I think also about discipline. You know, I think about athletes. They have to practice, you know, and the point of practice is to really build the muscle memory so that when you're in a game or when you're in the contest, you know what to do. And it's the same with training people for a military. And then also I'm thinking about, you know, I don't want to valorize prison gangs, but it was, you know, when I used to teach at prison, there were, they would tell me about the prison gangs who would have people out doing, you know, jumping jacks all the time. And they would be, a lot of people who are gang members in prison will have this really, really tiny, tiny, exquisite handwriting. And I asked how this happened, and they would say they would be given like a piece of paper, and they would say, we need you to write a, you know, 3,000 word essay on the history of struggle by by Chicanos against the dominant culture over the last 100 years. We need for you to write a 3,000-word essay on one piece of paper, and we need it by tomorrow. And the point is that was getting them, that was instilling in them this discipline to education and discipline were going together. It's like also, you know, or we go to my education, that I went to the Carroll School of Mines, and one reason that the School of Mines is so well respected in the engineering world is that they know, basically it's not what you learn in college, it's the fact that they know that you're willing to work. Because if you can survive the School of Mines, you can survive out doing engineering work because you went through a 4-year boot camp. And then that takes us back to the military. I'm pretty stunned at how so often in so many areas of our lives we recognize the importance of discipline, but somehow among at least some groups of activists that becomes a dirty word. But once again, it's not a dirty word when it comes to athletics. It's understood in many other areas of our lives how important it is. Music, writing.
Yeah. You know, I think that the reality of the horrors facing the world is really sobering, and as such, we need to act as if we're sobered to them by living daily conscious of that reality and asking ourselves constantly, you know, what can we do? What can we do? And again, that doesn't mean burning ourselves out, but it means finding a balance and taking ourselves seriously enough to know that we can be both serious activists and, you know, have a good time as well.
Right.
So then the last point I wanted to address is about horizontal hostility, something that activists unfortunately know too much about. So in the internalized powerlessness that a lot of us radicals have to beat the ruling class, we instead turn and fight each other because it's easy, because we have so much emotion that's generating so few results, and we need to see some results. So, you know, taking each other down is a result in its own right. And so first that manifests a lot in this kind of hatred of leaders and rules. And I think that this is really misplaced. There's a great essay I would invite readers or listeners to check out called The Tyranny of Structurelessness by Joe Freeman. It's fairly old, but I think it's really relevant to today's radicals. And she writes about how in the, you know, absence or in the expressed absence of structure and leaders still emerge. It's just now you can't say it out loud, and therefore you can't set up mechanisms for accountability. So leaders still exist, but you can't call them leaders. And since they won't be called leaders, you can't have rules set up that say, you know, if a leader violates ABC, then here's the repercussions, and then we get to choose a new leader. And she writes that groups in the greatest need of structure are least capable of creating it, which I think is a perfect diagnosis of radical subcultures. So the subcultures really eat alive leaders as well. You know, anyone that has some kind of success in their work or is recognized publicly for it is maybe deemed an elitist or just generally ostracized until they leave, until they give up. And it's extraordinary how much energy a lot of radicals spend on attacking each other versus attacking actual power. I mean, we could go through a list, thousands, millions of entities that deserve our hostility and our energy, but I think that so frequently we see that whole giant scroll of worthy enemies is bypassed so that we can attack someone else who, you know, has maybe 80% of our own politics, but disagrees with us on a few points, and so therefore is just evil incarnate. And I think that I'd like to be so optimistic and idealistic to think that we actually can get along, that it's possible. And we don't have to agree with each other. We don't even have to really like each other very much. But, you know, as activists, we can recognize other activists doing their own work and just give them decent respect and, you know, work together if possible.
I completely agree, obviously. And a couple of things about this. One of them is that, I guess three things. One of them is that one of the things that surprised me that I was completely unprepared for when I became, you know, something, when I entered the public eye some, is that over the years, I've received thousands and thousands of pieces of hate mail. And that surprised me, that why would anybody bother? You know, I don't, you know, there are plenty of economists or whatever whom I can't stand, but I'm not going to send them hate mail. But the other thing that surprised me was that out of all this, probably total, maybe 200 to 300 of those pieces of hate mail ever have been from right wingers, you know, like people who are upset because I don't like capitalism, you know, from stalwart capitalists. And the vast majority have been, this ties together the purity and the horizontal hostility, the vast majority have been from vegetarians because I eat meat, or anti-car activists because I have a car, or anti-banking activists because I have a bank account, or anarchists because I don't adhere to anarchist ideology, all down the line. And the thing that I finally realized is connecting them all is that all of those are basically lifestyle choices. But my real point is, it's just stunned me that the vast majority of hate mail I've ever gotten has been from people who would probably agree with 90% of my analysis. That's just crazy to me. And that's one thing. The second thing is, I want to use a quote from an anarchist to validate what you were saying about why we turn on each other. And it's a great quote, I think. When we are powerless to impact the world in such a way where we can see the impact of our blows, it makes sense to attack things that get injured. Which, it doesn't make sense to me, but I'm saying that that's just an articulation of this impulse, that if you feel powerless, and, you know, then you lash out those next to you. And then the third thing I want to say is a line that I learned from Judith Herman. Actually, it's not a line. It's an idea I learned from Judith Herman, where she said that so often adult children of abusers end up hating the bystander more often than they end up hating the abuser. And the reason for that is because the bystander was always emotionally safe. And so, you know, if you attack one of your comrades, the comrade doesn't have the power to imprison you. As opposed to if you really go after the state, you know, then that can have scarier consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. That second quote that you read, that was said unironically?
Oh, it was completely unironic.
Too bad.
I'm sorry, what?
I said that's too bad.
Yeah, it is. So we basically have like 2 minutes left. So, you know, you've provided this great introduction. What do you want for listeners to do with the information that you have provided them? I mean, you've got some analysis here. So what am I supposed to do with it? What is anybody else supposed to do with it?
Well, it took me about almost a decade, having gone through the different subcultures I did, to come out on the other side and have to make a choice of whether I wanted to just give up because I felt so bruised and disillusioned, or if I wanted to continue with radical activism and kind of start from, I chose the latter, and I'm very glad that I did, but I would have, you know, sympathy and understanding for those who would choose to give up, because it's really difficult if you think that this is the only game in town for as far as radical activism, And my hope, and I'm writing a book on the subject right now, is that I could reach new activists and that they could bypass what I'm calling the subculture trap, you know, if possible. I don't think I didn't have other activists around me when I was first delving into radical politics to tell me that I have choices. I thought that the punk rock, when I found it, I thought that was basically all there was. And, you know, each time I moved to a different subculture, I thought that that was all there was. But I never felt fulfilled as a human being, and I never felt like I was being effective as an activist. So in the end, my goal is to help a new activist realize that they don't have to settle for that and that another activism is possible.
Well, thank you so much for that, Ben. If people are interested in reading more about what Ben has to say about this, they can go to www.benbarker.org. I'd like to thank you for being on the show, Ben, and I'd also like to thank the listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ben Barker. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.